I don't know. I don't know how to start these now. It's been like fucking 1,000. I was doing finger guns for a while. I'm done with that. Yeah. I think I just figured out.
No, it's solid. It's solid. You can always start a conversation with finger guns.
How you doing,
Mike? It'll let you know who you're having a conversation with very quickly.
That's true. That's very telling. It is a good litmus test for your crowd. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. It's another sunny day where I'm at in Las Vegas right now, and just enjoying the work from home life.
You have that very like work den vibe in there. Simple, a little couch for the 15-minute power nap. We've got the soundproofing.
It's perfect. Yeah, this is where I spend most of the days for work days at least, and self tape room. So it's good.
Right. We got to get into both of those things because really your world is still, you've still got the acting, but you've taken on this editing thing in a really big way. And I'll go ahead and start us off by being transparent as I try to be at the top of these episodes. How do I know Mr. Michael Johnson, everybody, who I'm very happy to have on the show today? I was at school with Michael. We were there at the same time. I'm 2013 or 2015. So we're just a couple years apart. Barring like 2 months of the time you were in school, I was dating one of your classmates for the whole fucking time you were in school. So your class was like, I spent a lot of time with your class just by surrogacy.
Yeah, we knew you.
Of dating Becca. So the other way that is so interesting to me, we haven't talked a lot in the last like 8 years or so, but I got put in touch with you via Stephen Kopp, who's been helping produce the show. Yes. And he was, you know, we were going back and forth when I brought him on as a producer. And I said, I got to offload some of this editing work, specifically the short form content. And he was like, man, you got to talk to Michael Johnson. I was like, Michael Johnson, the actor? And he's like, Michael Johnson, the actor and editor. And I was like, for real? So he started telling me all the stuff you were doing with his content and catching me up on your kind of journey through this stuff. And I was like, I had no idea. This is my favorite part of doing the show, dude. I'm like, what the fuck is he even doing?
Right.
And then I find out that you've like built this skill set or maybe you had it all along. I don't know. But I brought you on to the show. And if people are fans of the show, they've been seeing your clips on Instagram. We've been pushing those out, Instagram, YouTube, other places. And I'm so happy to have you involved in the project, man. It's starting to feel like we got a little family going.
Yeah, it's always nice when you have like a team of people that you can just like collaborate with. I'm realizing as I'm like working with clients and things like that, and with you, and with Steven, like just how like comforting and nice it is to be able to collaborate in the fullest sense of that word. Right. So yeah, it's always best when you have like a whole team behind you, and it seems like we're building towards that.
Yeah, it's new, but I definitely think that we've got a vibe going and I'm really enjoying what we're doing. And I've always said about this show, just a little context since we have Michael today, I've always done this show by myself from 2014 when I started it and the several times I kind of rebooted it, brought it back, it went away, come back. Every time from top to bottom, always until this year, every episode you heard was fully me, from booking to shooting to obviously hosting, editing, making clips, doing emails. Every single part of it was my thing. And that's a lot of why it would kind of disappear for a little while, because it's just a lot of stuff to have to manage. Every time it would start to get bigger, right, it would be like, shit. And this time, with the intent of keeping it going as perpetually as I can, I just said to I said to Brandon, really, and to myself, I gotta fucking figure, I got more people who are involved in this and kind of, you know, it makes sense that it would be a more alumni driven group thing. I'm really happy to have you on, man. I think it's been really fun.
Yeah,
like
you
said, it's the collaboration is so great. Like even getting your thoughts on the content for a thing that's been in my head solo for so long is great.
Right. And just like working specifically with you and with like Steven and a couple other people who are from the school, it's so important to like share a vocabulary with whoever it is that you're working with. And there is that familiarity and that ease when you're working with, you know, somebody from the school who just like, oh, right. We have so many shared experiences and references and know the same people that we can use the exact vernacular to get across what we're trying to say.
Saves time, which saves money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's be honest. We get adults. Those are the big two.
I wax poetic. I can do that.
Yeah, sure. Why not? We're all here to party. Speaking of partying, let's go back. Let's ask my only stock question. I kind of know the answer to this, but I don't really. Where are you from?
I am from just outside of Portland, Oregon. I grew up in a town called West Lynn, Oregon, which is almost a lie because I really grew up on the side of a mountain called Pete's Mountain, right on the Willamette River in the good old Pacific Northwest.
Did you say you grew up on the side of a mountain?
Yes. It was a what big is that? Mountain.
What? How is that different from growing up, let's say, at the bottom of that mountain or not on a mountain at all?
More trees, more like wildernessy areas of it, a lot more farmland.
Is it a small town?
I wasn't. Say again?
Think of it as a small town.
Yeah, I think of it as I grew up on the small town part of a small town.
Wow.
So okay. It was like to get to the town took about 15, 20 minutes of like just driving down this mountain path. So like there was like the home life and then school was like this other town essentially.
Right.
And I moved there when I was like 5 because I was originally born in Cupertino. In California.
And then we moved up there. The Apple campuses and all that.
Yep. That's and my parents were Silicon Valley people. So that was where they were from. Yeah.
That's usually my next question. I have a really bad Oregon joke. Do you want to hear it?
I always want to hear it. Yes.
Why did America take the Pacific Northwest from the Native Americans?
Why?
Because they're Oregon donors.
I just want to sit with that for a second. It's not the worst one. It's not the worst one.
I told you it was bad.
You pronounced it correctly. I do appreciate that. I meet a lot of people who say Oregon.
Really?
Or Oregon. Yeah.
No way. Not Oregon. That's a joke.
I've heard Oregon. Yes. Like they thought it was like oregano.
Yeah.
I'm from Oregon. Yeah. Like it was a spice or something like that.
They named it after Ronald. It used to just be, you know, Outer Washington.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
So tell me about your folks. Why did you guys move from, if they're Silicon Valley people, why go to the side of a mountain? Wi-Fi is going to be terrible.
Wi-Fi. Well, it apparently was, I don't remember too much to be honest. my dad had a company that he owned and operated and then, sold it. No, he didn't sell it. He just stopped doing as much through it and changed to be like a freelance guy.
Sure.
And then from when he was no longer like a company man, he just hated living in Cupertino so much and like the traffic and all that. So they sold their house for like a good chunk of change and then moved up to this town in Westland, Oregon and took the whole family there. And it was like in the middle of the school year, I remember. So it was a weird transition. My sister was not happy about it, but I was, you know, 5 years old, so ready to make friends.
How old's your sister? Is she your only sibling?
She's my only sibling, yeah. So I'm the youngest of two. My sister's 3 years older than me.
Okay.
And yeah. She was just out here for a while.
So you're one of those stories where you got a family, they got started, and then mom and dad were like, man, this city. Fuck this city. Like, we just don't want to be in the middle of this anymore. And we're not even maybe sure that we want to raise our kids in the city. Like, we want them to have that bit more of a small town vibe, because my parents kind of tried to do that, which is funny to me because, you know, my mom and my dad had my sister, who's only my half sister, is only my mom's kid, but she's 9 years older than me. So I relate to the younger brother thing. Mm-hmm. And my dad tried to move us out to a farm, our family farm that my like grandparents owned, when I was like 7, with that kind of same mentality that you just mentioned. He had always been working for these big car dealerships and stuff like that. And he was like, I want to get out of Dallas. I want to get out of the big city. We'll go out to the farm and all this stuff. Dude, we were there for like fucking 4 months and we moved to Austin. My mom and I were like, no, there's fucking nothing here. What are we supposed to do? Like, we were too city ready and I was only 7 and my sister was living somewhere else at the time. And, I love hearing those stories that kind of did go that way. And you ended up having, so you stayed till 18. Did you?
I stayed till 18. Same house. They got really hit hard by the 2008 market crash.
Ah.
So they had to like short sell it and ruin their credit. It's a long story. But yeah, that was where I was till 18. And it was a great, I didn't know how good I had it at the time. I don't think any kid knows quite at that level. But
you mean like the benefits of having the small, what do you mean by how good
like
you
had it? It was a very nice house. I grew up very like privileged, very, very well cared for.
Sure.
They weren't like, my parents weren't extremely wealthy. They were in severe debt, as they would later admit to me. But
it was living a middle class life from day to day.
Yeah, it was a comfortable life. We didn't like want for much. And it's hard to like know where you're at in a societal view at, you know, 10 years old.
It's not your responsibility to know where you're at.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. But it is my responsibility to bring up and be like, now that I have a little more life
Absolutely.
Experience. Yeah.
Well, and you get that context later. I think that's one of the things that I struggle with right now with watching from a distance. I don't have any kids. I don't plan on having any, but when I watch the younger generations, they're so active and progressive in so many ways, which I think is so great. I'm like so excited for that. It's cool to see, especially after, I can't remember the name of the organization, but all the kids in Florida at Stoneham Douglas there was a school shooting, and then they were in the news for like a year out there. Like we're doing, they're at the pulpit and all that. I'm on fire about seeing stuff like that and the activism, but at the same time, it's tough because when you're like a 13-year-old activist, you only have so much context about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just don't know really what it's like in a two towns over. You don't get the bigger context of what other people might be going through and experiences. Their heart is in the right place, but you're not responsible for that. That's why I love to see that, but you can't hold anyone responsible for like knowing where they're coming from when they're 11. You don't know anything else. As long as you figure it out eventually and you're like, you know what? I'm not going to brag too much later. I'm just gonna be humble.
It's like a graph. You just want to see it move in the right direction.
I think
just
that's exactly right.
In the right direction. That's what we hope for. That's upwards. What I hope for. Yeah.
So when do you find the theater thing? When does that show up? Are parents creative in their Silicon Valley stuff? Or are they like nerdy engineer types?
So yes and no with that. They my dad is a pianist. By just hobby. He grew up very Catholic and was trained by nuns, so had like a lot of structure and rigidity with the arts, I think. But had a love for it. So there was always passion for like music. Art growing up, it was always just like Beethoven and Mozart and Tchaikovsky and Coltrane and Brubeck and just like really, really beautiful, beautiful music.
Yeah.
But that was about it. He's a software engineer. My mother was an electrical engineer. One of the first women to be in that job. She went to Stanford. Both of them were like some of the earliest members of their family to leave their hometown. So
where are
like,
they
going
from?
Back
are they from California?
No. My mom is the only member of her family to have left Pueblo, Colorado.
Okay.
And my
that's not a big place.
That's not a big place. I've been so many times. It's a very small place.
I've been through it. I just love Colorado. I got married there. I'm just like a Colorado nerd. I'm probably going to move there one day.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's amazing. And Pueblo is like not a big town to be from.
No. And I feel like it's an exaggeration, but I feel like half that town I'm related to in some way.
Oh, I'm sure you are. That's how those towns work.
I was shown newspaper clippings of like that side of the family where there's like a bar fight and all the members are extended family members. And I'm like, yeah, that tracks for that.
Right.
That town.
What about pops?
My dad is from, he was born in Baltimore, but grew up in Detroit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bit of a globetrotter, at least in the States. He's really been around. Likes the North though. That guy
likes the North, likes the cold, likes the sun. I think they like moving about. We've never been like a rooted family. We've always been.
You said
been,
you
like,
lived in the same house for like 18 years.
But I mean like location wise, like we didn't bounce around as much, but we've never been like, we miss that one place. It's always, we're very much living in.
Oh, I see what you got. Yeah.
Like,
so there's
never
an affinity
as much
for
of
the
like,
change.
What if I'm homesick? Yeah.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. So the first part of the question, which I kind of buried, but when do you find the theater thing?
Yes. So I didn't do anything particularly acting wise or arts wise until like probably middle school, probably sixth grade. It was probably a class that I started.
That's usually when it becomes like an elective that you can actually do.
Yeah. And I had the most fun with that. I always wanted to be doing it. That's where I saw Whose Line Is It Anyway for the first time, which essentially the whole class in middle school was just watching that over and over.
That's such an easy, like, substitute theater teacher kind of thing to throw it on.
It wasn't a great education in it, but it was a great introduction. Right. I got to say.
You're like, I have ABC. It's actually on the antenna. I can watch it whenever I want.
It's funny. And then from there, I just kept it going as like my extracurricular. I didn't do sports that much.
That surprises me. You have like kind of a sports vibe. Do you like sports?
I love playing sports. I don't like watching as much, but I do love playing. And I was very short until like right at the end of high school when I had my growth spurt. So I was like 5'5" for most of my high school life.
You're like the little guy. And then now people see you and they're like, what happened?
I was tiny. Yeah.
That's funny.
Never really worked out. The one sport that I did play was baseball, and there was like high school politics involved in me not being on the team. It was a whole thing.
Dude, you still look like you could be like the basketball star on One Tree Hill or some shit. You still look like you could play a fucking 17-year-old who's like great at whatever, lacrosse or some shit. You totally have that vibe.
Thank you. I appreciate that. However, every time I'm in the room, they're just like, you act a little too old, so we can't quite use you. You use a lot of words in ways that we don't think they would use.
Right.
So I was always
told that things cap. That's your first thing. That's the new one. You just gotta say cap. Say that a little more often and you're gonna crush it.
I'm cracked. No cap. I've picked up a little.
You still say it like you're 45 years old.
Yeah. I've been 45 for most of my life, and I'm just slowly growing into my age.
I'm that way too.
And it's a great ride. It's a good
100%.
Ride.
100%. Well, because when you're like that and you're one of those, you know, some people call them old souls, I just think it's an environmental thing that when you're growing up, you see adults having a better time and more freedom than you do. And you're like, I can't fucking wait to do that. This is bullshit. That was my experience. And I think most of the people I talk to feel exactly the same way. I feel like there is something there of that is an interesting artist to me, because what's really cool about that mentality of I kind of can't wait to be older is you don't feel the pushback of, oh no, I'm running out of time.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people who overvalue their youth and are like, oh no, it's slipping away, I'm not young anymore. The people who struggle with that, which I can have compassion for, but I don't relate to it because I'm like, fuck that. It's not that valuable. And I can still have like a childhood spirit and imagination and all the good shit that comes with being a kid, but I want to be able to do whatever I want all the time. I want to be able to like get wiser and understand things. And you do strike me as that kind of person who's kind of always carried that around. Do you find that gets in your way trying to connect with people who do hold on to that youth that maybe are your same age? Do you feel older than your peers, like in high school or college?
Yeah, I mean, I always felt older than my peers for sure. I think that part of that comes from like not having very many friends and kind of I was bullied a lot. That's very much in my past. For just being nerdy, for being weird and nerdy and
sensitive.
Sensitive. Yeah. That whole rigmarole thing.
Totally.
I think that is part of it, of feeling like very separate from people of my age. But I also think it's less about the external factors, and it's really more of like a grounding of an internal factor. Like it does make it hard. It does make it more difficult, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the wrong move.
Right.
It's just, that's the way that it's fallen. You know, that's the way that it's dealt to me. Which is my mentality for a lot of stuff that's happened in my life. But yeah, it's more like I need to live my life in this way. Like I can't capitulate and change the core tenets of who I am in order to make this external thing easier.
Why not? Everybody does that shit, man.
Yeah,
you say it like it's this automatic thing, but a lot of people struggle with that. They spend their whole lives capitulating because they think that's right. The answer. How did you know to stick to your shit?
Because through trial and error, trying to do things that, you know, it's that inner voice that you always have. And it's just you start listening more and more to it, the more hurt you right. get by ignoring it, I think. So
there was an attempt at some point then to kind of go with the crowd, yeah, be like I them. Mean, and then you're like, oh no, fuck this. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah. I think there were multiple like 30-second attempts of like trying to join in. And totally. Then just like, that's left a bad taste in my mouth. Let's not try
that. I don't
that.
Think I personally admit enough that I did that too. Cause I am very much like you just said, I was always like, hey, what are you guys doing? Nah, no. I tried to try to do that, but very quickly was like, I don't belong here. This isn't fun for me. I don't get what you guys are talking about or what's interesting to you is not interesting to me, whatever it happened to be.
Yeah.
But I don't think I say enough out loud just kind of to be humble that like, oh, I tried at first.
Oh,
for
yeah.
sure. Because what else do you do? Yeah. I wasn't so up my own ass when I was 13 that I was like, I know what to do and I don't care what my peers think. And I know you all keep calling me a fag and I'm not sure if that's true or not yet, but what, you know, it's like I wasn't like instantly aware. And I don't think any of us are because we all really do want that social acceptance at that time.
It's I don't think it's like the up your own ass element of it.
Right.
You do. I should speak in personal. I have in the past stepped too far in that direction and been like, ugh.
Same. Same.
But, you know, it's you're learning social skills. You're learning right. where those lines are. You're learning how that is. And it was always more of like a familiarity and like a comfortability with it of like, oh, no, I'm just more comfortable doing the thing this way or not right. doing the thing as it turned out to be more of.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, this feels right. And that was always like the cue of like, okay, so we'll hold on to this for now. And then we'll go later. See if anything needs to change with that.
North Carolina is very far away from Oregon.
That was very intentional.
Go on.
My family didn't necessarily get along in the best of ways. We're so tight now. We've all grown and made so much growth now.
What was tough at the time about the dynamic?
We were a non-denominational Christian household. That was a very okay. big thing. We are definitely no longer that anymore. I consider myself an atheist. I just don't believe. I have so much
As
love for
I.
people who have faith. I do not have that.
Yeah.
And that's where it is. So I've seen just like living in a church life and, you know, at the time of like figuring out what I wanted to do with my life and career and the choices that were like all of a sudden at my feet. I just needed to get away. It was a small town. I was very sheltered and I knew that just like literal miles would be a cure for a lot of the things. More problems come with that, I think, when
sure,
you have no support
stuff.
System,
yeah,
like within a driving distance.
Right.
But yeah, I just needed to get away from that. There was a lot of church people.
Let me ask you this because this is very interesting to me. You got four people in your family, right?
Yeah.
Like your immediate family. When you're a little kid, you're going to church, right?
Yeah.
There's four of you going to church. You're all like, I'm Christian. You said right now, as of now, are none of you identify as Christian anymore? Like you're not
in that realm? My sister and I don't identify okay. as being religious people. My mom still would consider herself Christian. She still reads the
okay.
Bible. My dad, I truly don't know.
Right.
It's not a conversation topic we have too much.
Just a
he
gray
says
area
he
thing.
Believes, Yeah, it's kind of like the, do we ever really know what our fathers think?
So he's in that, like, you're kind of agnostic about your father's Christianity.
Essentially.
You're like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It could be there. But neither of them go to church anymore. They don't participate in organized religion.
Do you mind if I ask where that change kind of started? Was it like you first being like, this is not for me? Was it sister? Did you guys all stop kind of going and slowly stop?
So like, there was one big event that happened. As soon as I came back from college, I sat down with them and I was like, if this relationship is going to continue, I got to come clean. I don't believe in God. I don't want to go to church.
After graduation or after like your first semester?
After the first semester.
Got it.
Yeah. Which was great. And they handled that so well. I think in the back of their minds, they were still like, maybe in a couple of years you'll come back, but they never
wishful
did anything
thinking.
With that. So my mom used to work for the church for a period of time. She used to work for this one church, doing like the outreach and community programs. Mm-hmm. She basically fed people. She's wanted to feed people her entire life. And for a period of time, she fed these people. The elders, particularly one elder, did not care for my mother, and so began a rumor campaign and spreading lies about her. And then the craziest part of the story, my mom gets in a motorcycle accident. She gets helicoptered to a hospital. I get a call while I'm at school from my dad, who's sobbing, who, you know, is not a man who
cries.
What
year is this for you?
This is my second year, beginning of my second year.
Got it. I was there.
Yeah. And so for a couple of days, we thought she wouldn't make it. It was just a very bad accident.
I didn't even know about this. Oh, my goodness.
While she's recovering in a coma in the hospital, this elder of the church draws up an emergency meeting and basically fires her from this like barely paid position and essentially excommunicates our family from this church in a very, very, very uncool non-Christian way.
They knew about the accident and all the stuff.
They
coincidence.
Knew supremely about the accident and emailed them while she was not conscious yet.
They were opportunizing her tragedy.
Yes.
Fuck.
So that was the end of organized religion.
Yeah. How do you trust the fucking group after that? That's crazy.
You just can't. And I think in this country, we could have a whole conversation about religion.
Sure.
Like, in this country, I do think that is like, that was the trajectory that a lot of places started going on, was just like not doing what they think they're doing and being pretty monstrous about it. So, yeah, that was the reason that it kind of stopped.
That's going to rattle you, man. I mean, that's going to rattle you from top to bottom, even if you're there. Yeah. I know that I met a few different people at School of the Arts. I don't want to quote anybody because I don't want to get this wrong, but I definitely met a few people who's like, for example, they were born into a mother and father family. The father came out as gay later. The parents got divorced. The father went, and this is more than one person I'm actually talking about in my head, but the father then later, you know, married a man. But the family originally was Christian. And even when they came out as gay, they're still all Christian. They all still want to go to church. But the church was like, no. Like, you guys can't keep coming here. And that actually ended up leading to them living a more kind of, at the very least, it's an old word, but I find it applicable more often, a transcendentalist kind of Christianity, where they're like, it's between me and him. I don't need the group. I don't need the book. I don't need the rules. I got my own, clearly, because that's all betrayed me. So I'm going to just have my personal relationship. My wife is kind of like that. She was raised in really conservative Korean Christian church, and her parents are still there. Her dad's an elder, you know, very, very much. But for her, married to a white atheist, it's like a completely different relationship as you go out. And she, as opposed to many other people in her family, and it sounds like you kind of like this too, you know, she had to go. She went to college in San Francisco. Right. You had to leave. You know, she's from here, to give that context, but you had to get out. And as soon as you got out, you were like, yeah, I fucking thought this was not, you know, and I didn't, I just needed like 10 other people in the room to be like, you know, Mike, it's cool if you fucking don't want to fuck with that. That's okay. We still love you. Yeah. And you're like,
yeah,
like, you know, it blows your mind. It really does.
Yeah,
at that age.
It's really, you start just asking questions. You just start examining what it is that you do believe, because you've been told exactly what you believe until you've been given permission, as it were, to decide for yourself.
Right.
And thankfully we all made it out of the other side. Not to say thank God, but thank God.
Thank God. Between one atheist to another, man, thank God.
Yeah. It's in the vernacular at this point.
Yeah, for sure. I'm very grateful for that, because I mean, I also ride a motorcycle. So anytime I hear motorcycle accident as in a sentence, I'm like,
yeah.
Are they
it was on my motorcycle. I've never driven since then. I was at school at the time, and she's been driving her whole life. And I had just gotten my license. And
she'd
like
been riding her whole life, like on
she'd
bikes?
She'd been riding bikes in Colorado on the Rocky Mountain trails her whole life.
Just bad
it was
day.
It was just a bad rain. And just hit a curve too weird. The whole family made an agreement, like, never again.
Sure.
So we've stuck to that because it was bad for a while.
Yeah, no, one of my dad's best friends lost his son when I was a teenager to a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. And I was already kind of riding, and my dad was like, ah, bro. And I was like, okay. And I just like, I didn't mess with anything for a long time. And then when I was in college, actually Becca's uncle passed away very suddenly. And he was a pilot who lived alone. He was single, and he had all these kind of like little toys that he would, when he wasn't flying, would like, you know, a little motorcycle, a little dune buggy, whatever, that he would play with, but then he wasn't there a lot. And then when he passed, they were like, we got to get rid of all this stuff. There's a tiny little 250cc or 150cc, whatever it was, that you remember that little white bike, the little chips bike I had? It was like an Eric Estrada mini.
Yeah. Oh, God.
A little white Honda C250 or whatever
That's
the fuck
right.
it was. And I was like, this is perfect. It tops out at 55 miles an hour. It's an automatic. And I fell in love with that scooter. And since then, dude, it's my compromise, because I can't really get myself into too much trouble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's perfect in LA for just getting around the street. I don't have that bike anymore because I had to sell it. But I replaced it. I got another one that's like very similar, because now that's my like, I won't ride a big body motorcycle in the city, and I certainly wouldn't ride it in the fucking country around mountains and fucking no way.
Great views.
I'm scared.
Great views. The memories
are gorgeous.
Fun.
Well, and yeah. I've always wanted to take a Harley trip with my parents, because my mom and my stepdad ride big bikes, and I don't really like them. But I was like, I've always wanted to do a like at least a weekend trip with them through the Rockies, not up in the mountains, but just where the views are adjacent.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it really is a beautiful way to travel, and it is a dangerous thing if you're in the wrong circumstances. But I always tell people, I'm like, you know, It's both. It's dangerous, but it's a beautiful way. With nothing around you, you're actually in the nature. And once you're competent, for the most part, you know, there's ways to stay safe. But so let's move on then.
Wear helmets. Last thing I'll say.
Wear fucking helmets, even if it's not the law in your state, because it's hilarious to me how many states in the United States still don't have helmet laws for bike riding. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's skip then, and let's talk about after school. You and I kind of talked a little bit before about this, but you mentioned post school, like right after graduation, pretty low point for you.
Yeah. So yeah.
You want to set that up for me?
Let's get into my drinking. I'm doing the finger guns.
Yeah.
Let's go. I am currently sober. At school, I was not. Very, very, very bad for especially the last 2 years. It was very bad. And
what does very bad mean?
Every day. I was blackout drunk almost every single night for a couple of years.
It's
and
intense,
I would
bro.
End my nights. It's bad. You normalize so much stuff.
Sure.
But,
I mean, I'm not saying good or bad. You can say however you want. I'm just saying intense, because that's a long time to keep that up.
Yeah, it did damage, but have recovered since then. I drank alone most of the time. I lived off campus, so I didn't have to, you know, defend myself to anybody. I would go to like a party and then I would have a couple of drinks and I would always leave early because I would start to like Jones to get like fucked up.
And you didn't want to do that in front of people?
And I didn't want people to see it. Right. People saw, you know, clearly people saw. Our mutual friend, I only had one friend that ever like seriously told me to that I should seek help. And that was our mutual friend, Wiley. And I thank him every time. I didn't listen to him at the time, but he was one that told me. Right. So bless him. It was just so bad. And it got to the point where I physically could not sleep without getting to that point.
And then when you sleep under those conditions, you're not even sleeping.
Yeah. It's just, I pushed through it. God knows what damage I did. You know, some mornings, if I felt too hungover, I would make myself throw up and then get to class.
Like boot and rally. Wow.
Yeah. Just like, that was life for me.
Well, let me ask you this though, before we move forward then, because, I take it for granted sometimes that people know me better than maybe they do. You know, I have zero judgment for you as I have this conversation. I can be kind of cold in my objectivity when I talk about things like this. So I want to make it clear that that's not how I feel. But I'm curious about the facts of this, because I think this is part of the story that a lot of times we glaze over, because I think at the end of the day, the feelings are more important, honestly. How you feel, what motivated everything, all that stuff. But what I'm interested in are some things like, bro, that program, how the fuck did you do that? I'm not trying to let you give yourself credit or anything, but I mean, like, how do you not get kicked out? How do you not, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Do you see what I'm getting at? How do you survive that?
I think I have to give a good portion of it to genetics. I think just genetically, I was able to physically drink and consume more alcohol than I would say an average person, which led into like it would take me more to get drunk, especially in the thick of everything. You think it's normal. And I think you've had to do a lot with it of just like, no, I can do this with a hangover, or I can do this, you know, still a little tipsy. I only ever did, I like set rules for myself. Drunks set rules for themselves so that they're not an alcoholic. And my rules were never do anything drunk. Hungover is fine, but you never do a performance drunk. You never go to a rehearsal drunk. You never do any of that. The only time I broke that was like one thing my first year, where I like had two beers before a movement thing or something like that. Right. And never did that again. And then the other was, I was only allowed to like drink, when I was like home. And you know, I drink at parties and stuff like that, but by sticking to those rules, I was able to then put literally the remainder of my energy and my ability to do things into performing, into like those classes and acting. And so it was only that, and then only drinking, and then just keeping moving back in that cycle, and, you know, trying my best to just hang on and figure it out. And I think I always knew, like down the road, like this is going to stop, this is going to crash and burn, but I never had the inner strength to make any particular day the day that I could stop it.
Right.
To like save myself. Cause I knew I was diabetic at the time, still figuring that out. And it just was like, I know this is not going to last, but I need it now, is what I kept telling myself.
Did the faculty know?
I mean, that's such a,
Let me rephrase. Yeah. Did the faculty approach you about this?
No.
Okay.
Faculty did not approach me about my drinking. Yeah, I had a couple of conversations about like nothing about my drug use. It was always like the perception of how I thought of certain teachers, and like certain teachers who deserved to not have my earned respect, if I'll be frank. And so it was always like, well, you need to play the game a little more. And it was always my problem with authority figures more than my substance problem, which is a pretty consistent trait throughout my life, I think.
So what changes when you graduate?
Rock bottom. I hit rock bottom.
What did that look like?
I was so, so fucked up every day, hiding it. I went back to Oregon before my plans were to move to New York after graduation. And so I was just going to work a summer job in Oregon and then move up to New York. That was the plan. Did not go that way. I got a DUI in Oregon and spent the night in a hospital because my blood sugar was so abnormally high because of all the booze I was drinking. That I never even made it to a county jail. I just was handcuffed in a hospital and had, you know, a family member pick me up. And it was that was really the moment where I'm like, okay, so I either have to accept that I'm just going to drink myself to death, or now is the moment. And for whatever reason, that was the moment. That was like, that was the final time I drank. It just, you hear people talk about like, oh, I try and, it takes me like three times to like really learn something. You have to experience a thing a certain number of times before you actually absorb it. And for whatever reason, that was the final one. It was just like, I can't do this. And I've been carrying it for so long that it just was like, I'm done. I can't do it anymore. So I found a great doctor who got me through withdrawals, which worst thing I've ever experienced in my life. I had auditory hallucinations.
What'd they tell you?
And did not, it sounded like white static and a woman screaming. So not pleasant. So that was a scared straight experience for sure. And then like worked with them to like make sure that my body was gonna be okay. And then I found a wonderful, wonderful therapist and just started going every week. Everybody do therapy. Yep. Please, for the love of God.
And if you're a woman of color, please let me know. My wife works with a wonderful agency in private practice, Women of Color in Sherman Oaks. Quick plug.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I want to get into like kind of what happened next, but before we lose track of this moment, please. First of all, and not to kiss ass, but man, you look great. You just seem like, and you seem great, not just look great, but you seem great. And you know, we weren't close at school, man. I barely knew you. I probably talked to you 25 times. And each one was maybe less than three or four sentences the whole time. I don't think we ever did a play together or anything, did we?
No, no play, no workshop, no acting. No, it's in stuff.
Yeah, intensive arts, nothing. I just kind of knew you adjacently. And what's wild to me is, and we talked about this on Steven's episode since we already brought him up. It is still hard for me because I grew up around a lot of what you're talking about. There's a lot of what you're discussing that's in my family amongst many people. And it's kind of like a badge of honor for a lot of people to be like, yeah, I do that. I do live that alcoholic life and I still pay my bills and I take care of my kids and I blah, 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 because they function. Because like all the stuff that you said about the rules you set, stuff like that. I don't go to bars and drive home. I only get fucking blackout drunk at night by myself. So that's better. You know, and I gotta say, I mean, if you're in that horrible place and you just can't get out, I'd rather you do it at home alone than drive around and stuff. Sure. Yeah, I guess that, you know, sure. And I give it to you the
so
same
thankful
thing. Like,
I never hurt anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. That you never had that problem and that you also, you managed this addiction along with some responsibility to say, shit, man, I do owe these people in class every day. It's the best version of me I can fucking muster. I owe it to my acting partners for them to at least have a semi, like, so the best version of me that I can bring to the thing, given that I'm struggling with this. And I, yeah. And I respect that. I respect that because it's tough. Because you don't want to hear that story and be like, good job, because obviously it wasn't good job. But bro, the addiction thing is a struggle for so many people, as you know, and the people that can get through it without harming anyone else or harming themselves, you know, that's not something to totally go past. And I think that says a lot about your character. I really think that one of the things that's tough about this, right, is that you did this in private. You did this all by yourself, right? And like you said, being bullied, coming from the situation you came from in your youth, you're not the kind of person to just start walking up to classmates like, bro, I got a problem, help me out. Like, you're not going to do that. You're just going to fucking handle it yourself. Be a fucking man, right? Or whatever's going off in your head about what you're supposed to do. And, you know, Steven kind of dealt with that similar thing. And I told him when he was talking to me about his struggles, I had no idea, you know, which I'm sure you've heard. And people are like, it kind of shocks us as people in your life to be like, what? This whole time, 2 years, Michael, is a long fucking time. It's a really long fucking time. And to be adjacent to someone and to not be aware because of however they're managing it. It is, here's my point about all of this. It is happening more often than people realize. It is happening more often around you than you realize. There are people, undoubtedly, if you were listening to this, there are people in your life that are going through a version of this and you don't know. And you won't know until they decide you get to know. And hopefully they come out of it before it causes any serious permanent damage. And you just got to be there and you got to put that, oh shit, what the aside, and just go, but you know what? You're here now and you're with this therapist, you're with this doctor, you're doing whatever you're doing. And you just have so much gratitude that's where we're at. Fuck everything that happened. Fuck you know? And that's why I think I also just like never sit in any judgment for addicts, because especially if I'm talking to addicts that are in recovery or that are have reached sobriety, they survived. And I know, and I'm sure you know, plenty of people who didn't. And honoring where that person is now and what they did to get through it, I think we just can't talk about that enough and tell those stories enough, because Hopefully, one person hears the episode with Steven. One person hears this episode and is like, I should talk to somebody. Maybe I should just let them in. Yeah. What would you tell those people?
You're not alone. And I know that's such, it's so difficult to parse through the platitudes, because so often there are so many grains of truth hidden within platitudes, but they're just thrown about so much that they lose that shine. But you're not alone. I think there's no one path to sobriety. I think truly what it is, it's an inner fight. It's a fight between your subconscious and your conscious mind. Right. And you know, the addiction is a tool, right? It's just a thing. It's an appliance.
Right.
I'm going to steal this from my therapist.
It's a coping mechanism, is it not?
It's 100% a coping mechanism. There's also, you know, chemical dependency stuff that is real and does.
Once it's established, that's a different dynamic. Yeah. Sure.
My therapist framed it in Star Wars. So I'm going to use this.
Yes, let's go.
New Hope. They're in the trash compactor.
Ooh, and you got two great analogy
closing in on you. And that the two walls closing in on you are the actual problem. Luke puts up that metal pipe in the middle. That's the addiction. That's the substance. And what it's doing is it's keeping those walls from crushing you to death. because that's the feeling. And it works. And it works for a little bit, and then it starts to buckle because it's not a permanent solution.
It's not meant to do
that. And it's not going to do it forever. So my addiction helped with my two walls, which were past trauma and future anxiety. And it propped them up. It kept them away. And it did it well enough that I could do my fucking art. And I thought that was fine. And then it started buckling, and then it was just out of control from that point on. And so having it framed like that, it was less about like, it's not necessarily my relationship with alcohol. It's my relationship with myself. So all that being said, to the people that may be listening who may have things that are weighing on them, that are affecting them. Every time you drink, I think it's a cry for help from yourself to yourself. And please listen and please take action. One of the things that did it for me was I had it's called, like, in Jungian terms, it's active imagination, where you just like have a dialogue with your inner character. And it was, I was, you know, communicating with myself. It was a younger version of myself, but I had this absolutely heartbreaking conversation because it's another one of those platitudes. You know, it's so difficult to give yourself the love that you're so willing to give another person.
Mm-hmm.
And what you could accomplish for yourself if you can turn that inwards.
Right.
If you can give yourself grace, if you can forgive yourself of your own expectations that you haven't lived up to, of you know, all these things that, you know, there's no greater critic than the voice in your head, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But just like, do the right thing for yourself, because you're so willing. I was so willing to carve pieces of myself off constantly in order to do the thing I thought I needed to do, to behave in the proper way or try and get the thing I wanted. It was just, you know, I was so ready to just leave myself behind and not knowing, you know, how heartbreaking that is. So do the right thing for yourself, because there's that inner child in you that just has all the hopes, has all the dreams, and didn't deserve any of it.
And needs you.
And reach out and hold that version of you's hand. And
that's a good starting finding the point. Door in the trash compactor.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's finding the door is like, maybe I don't have to be here. Maybe there's a different hallway.
Yeah.
Or if I take a moment and take a breath, I might be able to assess where I'm at.
Right.
Yeah. And
beautiful analogy, man. Yeah. I really like that. We give credit to the therapist.
So useful. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It was so useful for me. So I'm happy to share that with everybody else. And the just to put a button on this, the final thing that he shared with me was that he had this whole pamphlet thing to fill out. And I was like, oh yeah, for sure I'm depressed. And he was like, so you said you're depressed. And I was like, have you met me? Yes, I would like to think that. And he goes, interesting. Why do you think you're depressed? And so I listed out a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, so that to me reads less as depression and more of like a healthy response to tragedy. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm allowed to feel sad. And that's right. All it has to be.
Yeah.
And just like giving yourself permission to feel a spectrum of emotion, especially in this profession, feel the spectrum of emotions without having a perception of it, you know.
It's dude, like the irony there is wild, because you've got a guy, it's a guy, right, who's telling you this?
Yeah.
You got a guy who's telling you, Michael, you need to embrace the fact that you are allowed and capable of having a full spectrum of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
You just spent 4 years training
4 years,
to pretend to do it as other people.
Yeah.
Only to then have a guy be like, you know what your big problem is you don't do that for you.
Well, I think the interesting thing is what beautiful training I had at the school. We'll never question that. what horrendous trauma I also had at the school.
Sure.
Both things are true. I think the difference between realizations and epiphanies I had in therapy and the ones that I had in school were that the epiphanies were in service of the show. And the epiphanies in therapy were in service of myself as a human right. being.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily casting judgment on one or the other. I think that both have a necessity in them. You know, it's a negotiation when you're performing of what of myself do I give and what do I hold? And what, you know, what is this balance, this give and take within the character and myself?
Mm-hmm.
But what I think the school struggles with, and there are many things
at that time,
especially at that time, especially in the,
yeah,
in
this
the
is like
years
10 years ago, we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like, it doesn't matter your whole thing. As long as you can get on the stage and do it beautifully, we don't care about anything else. And that was my experience for sure. I want to touch that for a second
because yeah. I, as someone who was around that school for a long time, like literally there for like Van Wilder time frame, mm-hmm. I watched a lot of people say that. I heard that all the time.
Right.
And yet my theory is, with all due respect to you and everyone who's ever said that, I think that was you. I don't think that came from the education, in my opinion, only because, especially as a directing student, and this is kind of, I don't know if this is an ethical gray area, but as a directing student, you get way more of a behind the scenes kind of experience with the faculty because you're their assistant directors. And we sit in directing class with them and we talk about the actors in a way they never hear. It's just the nature of the program. And the intention for so many of these teachers, maybe not every single one, I can definitely think of a few exceptions. However, the intention for most of the acting teachers was health and happiness for the students. They didn't just want to make a good play. Half of them are retired from making great plays. They want right. you to learn and get better and be good and be happy. Now, their traumas are informing the way that they're giving that to you. Yes. And I saw moments, we all saw Matt Bullock go too fucking far and be too mean, but that man loved every fucking kid in that school. He was doing it the way he thought he wanted to do it. And for me as a kid who didn't go right out of high school into college, here's the ethical dilemma that we're in. And this is why I say, I think it's on the students. I don't blame those students. I don't blame you for feeling that way. I think it's a relationship of going right out of high school into this thing and not knowing how to separate what the play needs and saying, yeah, but I'm a person. I'm going to take care of myself first. And then if I have anything left to give to the play, I will give it to the play. Like, you always had the right to do that. And they're never going to come and like punch you in the face. Like, you might get in a back and forth argument, but I've never watched anyone get kicked out because they took care of themselves over doing something they were supposed to do in a play. It was not the intention of that to happen. But I think that work, in my opinion, bro, I think that school and I think that work, that training, I don't think anyone under the age of like 21 should fucking do it. I don't think you're ready for that shit.
So,
and if you were older and you had that fucking mentality, you wouldn't feel that responsibility to crucify yourself for a fucking play in North Carolina. No one's going to see, because you got the perspective to know that you're more important. You're only 21. You got a whole life full of being a person. This play is like a week.
Right. So I agree with the 21 thing. That Please. That to me sounds great. Just to touch on a couple of things, because I do differ on a couple of points, but I want to like shift the perspective of it a little bit. All of my choices were my own, 100%. At any time I could have stopped, I could have not done a thing. I am personally responsible for my actions and choices during my time there.
Right.
However, I did not have the same responsibility that faculty members did for the care and well-being of their students. They literally are receiving money to do this in a way that is not intended to cause damage. as an 18-year-old, which is where I agree with you on the 21 thing, you know, an unnamed teacher said, maybe if you're playing a character who drinks a lot, you should start drinking a lot. I think that's an irresponsible thing as a teacher to say to a minor. I'm not saying that that is that person's fault.
I agree.
But I think I on its head, I agree with what you're saying, but where I think it differs is, you know, the energy that is being put out into class is for the play. It's not for your well-being. It's more of like that was an unspoken thing. But like we went to school with crazy people. I would consider myself a crazy person. I think you have to be to do this shit. We take those things sometimes as religious text. And I think certain members of
that. But you don't think that is that a personal responsibility not to be so, like, to see that that's not helpful, to treat everything so preciously. And like Bob Francisconi used to tell us all the time, you guys are taking this nose shit a little too, like, on a pedestal. It's a piece of latex and string. We're just playing. Right. He would have to remind everybody, calm down with the like demagogy and the like building this up as a god of a thing, like and maybe more of the faculty needs to do that. But I'm also like, these kids are kids, but quickly into your first term, you're an 18-year-old adult, and part of being an adult is that personal thing. And I don't think the faculty at an acting school is necessarily responsible for the other part. I think you got to figure that part on your own. I just know how that gets built into the program.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I do find it interesting because I've had this conversation with multiple like alums. Yeah.
And that's what this podcast is, my man.
Yeah, I do find it fascinating the steps that all of us take to be like to defend the program, to defend a lot of stuff.
Sure.
Because I'm what I am not saying is that this stuff isn't also on me, but it's not only on me.
Right.
It can't be. If I'm paying $32,000 a year to do a thing, it's not 100% on me. Mm. It just isn't.
But what you get for that money, is that up to you?
What I got for the money was great training. It was the most useful form of trauma I've ever experienced.
No, but what I'm saying to you is this. When I was going into third year, they didn't have enough money to pay Laura Henry to stay at the school. That's the story we heard. I spent 2 years with my classmates, or one really, but there with them. And the years before they got there, Laura Henry. Oh my God, when you get Laura Henry third year, it's going to change your whole life. She's the greatest acting teacher on earth, everybody would just say. I was like, cool, can't wait. Summer before third year, we're supposed to finally get Laura Henry. They can't keep her. She goes back to LA. And they're like, I guess you're going to have Matt and Tanya in the fall again, because we don't have an acting teacher and we just like can't figure it out in time. Mm-hmm. And my class, not all of them, but by large, were furious because that's not what they paid for. And I, at the time, was like, fuck you if you get to pick who works here. Like, that's not up to you. This school that you said train me, you got to give them the ropes and let them do it. And they're trying their best, but it was a fucking money thing. It wasn't anybody's fault. And the fact that you can't have that thought of like, well, this isn't anybody's fault. Like, they couldn't make it happen. It was a deal that didn't go through, which is the business, by the way, you're trying to get into every fucking day. They couldn't make the deal go through. And instead of trying to make the best and going, but we're still here at like the greatest school and we're still going to figure out a way to get the most out, we're going to figure it out. That positivity, it was, I don't know, this is not what I signed up for and this is bullshit. And the attitude was shit. Ashley Gates had to come in and tell us like, you guys need to have a little perspective here. And we had to like have a come to Jesus so that a bunch of our students didn't quit. And I still think I have the same perspective on that. I think that there is a little bit of this program. First of all, it's way too expensive. We can agree with that. It shouldn't cost that fucking much money. Start there. Agreed, man. I'm still paying it off. However, with that kind of thing, I just don't, I think there's a danger in letting the students decide what they should get in detail from that thing. Because if they already knew what they needed to know, they wouldn't need the program.
So what is the danger that you refer to?
The danger in letting the students run the school?
Yeah. I'm not saying students should run the school, but what is the danger? Is it a physical danger?
Oh, no. Yeah. I don't mean a physical danger. No, yeah. I don't.
What I'm referring to is a physical danger. We had faculty members who were not safe. Certain people handling stage combat props were not safe because of things that were brushed under rugs. You know what I mean?
Mm. And you saw people get hurt because of that.
Yeah. I think if you have somebody who's handling like even dulled weaponry, they should be sober. And I think that
you saw people get hurt.
Yeah, I saw people get hurt. But even if I didn't, that's not a good thing. So what I don't want to get into a lot of shit because you and I could have a very long conversation about the school's history with like Title IX stuff. We could have a long conversation about its history with mental health stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I don't want to come out here and be like the school is evil, because that's not what I feel.
Of course not. You started with the training is great and the trauma is true.
But like to bring this back to like the conversation about, you know, my own conversations with myself, we have to accept the totality of the thing or else I don't think we get anywhere. I don't think we have that growth that everybody wants. And are there beautiful elements of the school? 100%. Are there treasured teachers? 100%. Ashley Jansen is the greatest human being I've ever met in my life. And that nothing will ever take the beautiful moments that I share with her away from that. Right. But also there's a dark side, you know?
Yeah.
There are elements of the school.
I don't push back against that as if that's not true. I've said it many times.
But I think going back to like we're stepping up to the defense of this thing. I feel like so often these conversations get into like semantics of just like, well, when you think about like an arts program, we have to be a little more ephemeral about our approach to it. And it's like, yeah, I get that. But also people shouldn't say certain things to like 19-year-old students. Mm. And I've saw and witnessed and experienced that. Those aren't my stories to share. But like, I feel like we need to get everything out as like alumni and current faculty and all this stuff, like get it out on the table and not have to pretend or choose a side. Cause
totally,
you know, I've personally lost friends from my class because of trying to talk about some of the real stuff. And, I don't know other people's relationships with it, but,
I agree with you completely.
And it takes inherent honesty.
I want to make it clear too, that this whole conversation that we kind of diverged here was on me playing devil's advocate on the idea of how much responsibility do you hold on taking things overly seriously, overly special, putting things on a pedestal to the point that you are crucifying yourself. You are harming yourself. And there is shared responsibility, which we agreed on. So I think we're on the same page about that.
Yes.
What I've always said, and maybe not always, what I've said even more recently and more articulately, I think, about this podcast and talking to everybody is, I've always said it's not a fucking jerk off about School of Arts, man. It just ain't. There's all sorts of stories, and I have mixed reviews. Obviously, I have mostly positive reviews, or I wouldn't do a fucking podcast about a school I hated.
Right.
But I recognize that it is complicated, and I also recognize that I had a very specific experience at that school.
Yes.
Not coming straight from high school, and I also spent a year and a half in Winston, in the community of School of the Arts, living with students, going to plays, doing all that. I got to like take a year and a half half-ass audit of the whole school before I even got into it. So I had context. I had more maturity. I had all these things that a kid going, all right, bye high school. Holy shit, fall at NCSA. That is a very different experience. And that's why I say this. this show is about what brings people to that school, and it is about how they cope with it, what happens to them while they're there. Yeah. And that is as much color as I'm going to put on it, because it is all over the place. And I respect the people that walk out of there and say, that school fucked me up. And do I blame them for that? No. Do I think there's likely some shared responsibility? Maybe, but it all depends on their circumstances. Some people just should not go into an 80-hour a week conservatory. They're not built for it. And just because you were the best kid in Beauty and the Beast at your high school doesn't mean that this is the right way for you to learn how to do this. Mm-hmm. I also don't think, and I go back to this every fucking time I can, it is not an appropriate training program for a 17 or 18-year-old child.
Yeah, that, I agree there.
You have 100%. To take a year off before you can go to a conservatory. Yeah. That should be the rule. And go do whatever you want. Get a job, go work professionally, non-professional, do whatever the fuck you want. Be a person.
Yeah.
Stop worrying about grades for a year. Don't listen to your fucking parents for a year. Don't be like, my momentum. Fuck all that shit, bro. Slow down.
The number of times I heard the phrase momentum being tossed around.
It's the dumbest shit I've ever heard. And it is the least helpful, maybe the most harmful of all the different things I've heard, is that notion of like, oh, don't take the year off after high school. You might just burst into flames or some shit. Like,
if you stop pedaling this bike now, you'll never get back on.
And it is so disrespectful to the notion of artistry, as if it is like spinning a plate and it falls off and you should quit. Like,
yeah.
The idea that, especially some of us, you know, I mean, you said middle school, I started middle school, but we all kind of started like trying to entertain our parents and be funny or whatever. When we were little, we've spent a long time working on skill sets of performance, audience awareness, humor, all this shit, storytelling. We've been learning this shit, bro. And you tell me if I take fucking 18 minutes to go on a hike and find myself that I can't do this for the rest of my life, fuck you. That is offensive. Yeah. And it is built in to this terrible system that we have that says you need this bachelor's degree that you have to go get right as soon as you finish high school, that runs them through this machine. And no wonder it beats the shit out of a bunch of these kids. Believe me, I don't want to seem cold. I just want to play a little bit of the thing of, you do at some point, and this is the point of college, or at least it used to be, I think, you have to get that personal responsibility of, it's not just the adults doing this to you. That can be fucked up. That can be traumatic. We have to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. But you also have to go, this acting teacher told me to start drinking. That sounds like a bad idea. And move on with your fucking life and don't do it.
No, for sure.
Like, it's just another adult. Now that you're 18 and they're 48, they tell you to do some shit. You can be like, that's stupid, and not do it. But it's tough when you're 17 and you want to be good.
And especially be the best. Exactly like you said, coming from one environment and community where you just are listening, nod your head and do what they say, to another environment where they're really encouraging it to.
No time to breathe.
Say. Exactly. Yeah.
And they're saying, attach your identity to this forever. Yeah,
this is the scope of your being is right here. Yeah. For sure. God, if I took a gap year, what would have happened? Who knows?
Well, I have to say, I had a lot of trouble connecting with people at school, I think, and even my own class, just because of that gap. It's like, I was like 2.5, maybe 3 years older than my class. It was hard. I didn't get it. And they're all like, I'm so worried about what everybody thinks all the time. I'm so tripping. Like, and my class had like extra those people who were like, I don't know what to do, like just nervous and anxious and oh my God. And I was like, this is acting school. We're not at MIT, you know, we're not going to build bombs that are going to blow up village. Like, this is acting school, man.
We
like,
all just put on tights and danced around for an hour and a half.
Yeah. And it's fun. It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
Like, and I had a lot of that energy while I was there. And then I would meet these kids who were like, you'd think they were at Harvard trying to get valedictorian. And I'm like, but that's not where you are, but it's okay to relax, breathe, and just kind of be with this. And I think you'll get more out of it if you just try to enjoy it.
I think it was actually Ashley who said to me once, like, the most growth that you have is when you let something go, is when you like step away from it. And I've always loved that. It's like the time where I don't think about a show or a performance or anything, that's where it all starts to like steep and percolate. And there's so much that happens within that silence.
Yeah.
And it's so often that we are encouraged to not have the silence, what's your next project? What's your next thing? It's like, dude, I just want to like sit for like 10 minutes. I got to have a meal at some point today. Like I got a laundry has been piling up for days now and I got to wear shit.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, definitely something that's encouraged in this lifestyle. Yeah.
Of course,
but also in this country, like we're always trying to do the hustle,
right? Your name's Michael. Knocking. What do you do?
Yeah,
that's the next question.
It's why I don't go to the like alumni things anymore, because just like everyone's like, what have you done? What have you been working on? What's this year's project? And I'm like, I don't know. I lived through COVID. Can I put my finger in my ass
this morning? Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Shut up. Like, how's your life?
How do you feel?
Yeah. It's all the stuff beyond it. Who was it? It was, I'm going to misquote it, but it's like Cillian Murphy did an interview where he was just like saying, I don't talk about my personal life a lot, but it's fucking awesome.
Right.
And I wouldn't be able, like you have to have that life. You have to have that year. You have to have something to draw on. You can't just live in the bubble of art.
Right.
It's a beautiful bubble. It's a gorgeous bubble, but there's so much more out there, and so much more to yourself. Give yourself credit. You know, you've got multitudes.
It's such a good sentiment, man. And I wish we had more time. I got to have you back on because I feel like we have more to talk about.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. Yeah.
It would be great. But dude, thank you. I cannot thank you enough for doing this today. First of all, for all your work on At the Elephants. I thank you and I appreciate all the stuff that you do for us. But man, the vulnerability, the honesty, and the candidness that you have with me today, I really appreciate it. I don't take that for granted at all.
And I love the devil's advocate stuff. I love like just being able to have like a respectful discussion about things like this. It's so rare that we're able
to do something. It's another thing I struggled with at school, man, because I talk about shit that pisses people off, but I do it with this kind of like, I'm just asking.
Yeah.
I'm not doing, I'm not asking you to piss you off. I want to know the answer.
No, yeah.
So thanks for getting it.
I do appreciate that. So thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to have work to help fuel me doing acting shit. So thanks.
Hey man, I love to give people work. If I had all the money in the world, that's all I would do. Amen. We'll talk soon, bud.
Yes. All right. Thank you again.